another day on our lovely retreat. And this morning I wanted to, on the Sunday morning, first Sunday morning talk, to give a talk on one of the obstacles, or the obstacles to meditation, namely the five hindrances. We did mention those briefly last night in the question time, but today I wanted to talk in detail about them, because these are the obstacles which you will meet in your meditation. These are the things you should look out for during this retreat, and to try and overcome these hindrances, these five obstacles to deep meditation. In the Pali language they're called nivarana. Literally they mean so just closing the door or obstructing, entering into something. And this is exactly what they do. They stop you from entering into these deep jhana states, and also they obstruct or weaken wisdom, and they strengthen the opposite of ignorance or delusion. So if you're going to say anything in Buddhism, you'll say that the five hindrances are probably enemy number one, which stop people becoming enlightened. And it's precisely for the reason of understanding these five hindrances and overcoming them that we are on this meditation retreat. I say understanding them and then overcoming them, because when we don't know them very clearly, where we don't really understand them, there's no real hope of overcoming them. In fact, sometimes in meditation, some teachers, they don't explain them clearly enough, and the students don't even give an attempt to overcome the hindrances. Especially the hindrances which are very subtle, which are the finer forms of these five things, these finer forms which stop you really getting into deep meditation. You don't even try and identify them and surpass them. And because of that, the five hindrances hold sway over the mind. They stop you enjoying the bliss of the mind, and they stop you developing the deep wisdom, the great insights of enlightenment. These five hindrances are what's between you and the enlightenment experiences, basically. So it's good to understand them. And when you know them, then you have a good chance of overcoming them. If you haven't got into jhanas, it means you haven't fully understood and overcome them. If you have got into jhanas, then you have overcome them. It's as simple as that. So, let's try and understand them on a superficial level, the level of speech and intellect. And if we can understand the five hindrances at that level, then maybe we can identify them when they come up into our mind and when they stop us going into deep meditation. But you should always know that if there's something stopping you going into the full jhana, it must be a hindrance in one form or another. The way the Buddha described the five hindrances, the first one, kamachanda, sometimes called sensory desire, second one, vayapada, ill will, third one, tina middha, sloth and torpor. Fourth, udicca, kukicca, restlessness and worry. The fifth, vichikicca, of doubt. And that's usually the order the Buddha lists them. And this is the order I'll explain them this morning. And I think the reason why the Buddha explained them in that order is because the first of the hindrances is the most important. It's kamachanda. And again, it's a hindrance which very few people, even meditators, fully understand, because it's that hindrance especially which stops you really getting into deep meditation. It's not just sensual desire, because that doesn't really cover the full meaning of that hindrance. First of all, karma, this is K long A, M A, as opposed to the law of karma, that's a different word altogether. And sometimes it can sound the same. But this is, karma is the world of the five senses, this external world, the world of sight, sound, smell, taste and touches, physical touches. That's this world of karma. And the chanda really means like delighting, even like consenting, just to agree to be those that agree to be in that world, to be interested in it, to get involved in it. That's all like karma chanda, involvement in the realm of the five senses. And for many human beings, they can't abandon that because they just do not know anything else. To give up the world of the five senses means literally to die to that world of the five senses. And they don't know anything else, it's just complete dying. It's one of the reasons why Ajahn Chah always used to ask the monks at the monastery, one of his repeated phrases, "Have you come here to die?" He would ask the monks, "Have you come here to die?" And this is what he was asking. Have you come here to let go of this body, to let go of this external world, to let go of these five senses? Because these five senses are the body. The body is the five senses. The five senses aren't there to protect the body. The body is there to keep the five senses going. This is the whole purpose of having a body, is to be sensitive, to be awake, to be seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, or touching something. And when you understand how the body equals the five senses, how the five senses equals the body, you get some understanding about what this hindrance of karma chanda is all about. It's that interest, the involvement, the concern, for all that is encompassed by those five senses. In practice, what this actually means is that when there's a sound outside, you can't let it go. You can't just discard it. You're interested in it. You listen to it. What is that? What does that mean? Is it dangerous to my body? Is it okay? Is it safe? Why is it in meditation that so many noises disturb us? The point is that because we're interested in those sounds, we actually go out to listen. What is that? What does it mean? What are they saying? Are they saying something about me? These are the sounds outside. The feelings in the body. It's we actually go out. If you look very carefully with deep mindfulness, you actually go out to the aches and the pains, the itches and whatever else is in the body. We can't just leave them alone. We can't shut them off. Why is it we can't shut them off? It's because that we're interested in that world. Because we are attached to that world. Now this is attachment. Not as a thought, not as an idea, but as a reality. You just cannot let it go. So this is actually what karma chanda actually means. And for many meditators, it's this which is just so hard to abandon, so hard to let go of. You sit here and you're on your cushion, on your chair, on your stool, wherever you are, there will always be aches and pains. I've been meditating for I don't know how many years now. But they still always get some aches and pains, some itches, something wrong with the body. The only way I can meditate is just to get it as comfortable as possible, but I know it will never be perfectly comfortable. And I'm sure even the Buddha was never perfectly comfortable when he started sitting. You sit down, this is good enough. You'll never be perfectly cool or perfectly warm. You'll never be perfectly quiet. There'll always be some noises outside. But this is good enough. Okay, set up the body as best as possible. Right, that's it. Goodbye. I'm going somewhere else. This is what you do with the body. You literally discard it in your meditation. You sit down, you don't care whether the mosquitoes are biting the body. You don't care whether it's too hot or too cold. You don't care the sounds going on outside you, what anyone else is doing. What the person next to you is doing. You don't worry about the pains in the body. The body can look after the body. I'm just going to go off into the world of the mind. You have to have that degree of renunciation to the world of the five senses, to the body. A sense of like just discarding it. I've dealt with it long enough now. Now it's my holiday time. Same way in the work which you do, gets to 5 o'clock or 5:30 on a Friday afternoon, doesn't matter if there's work to be done. That's it, I'm knocking off, I'm going home, bye-bye. Come back on Monday to do all that work. And this is what we do with the body in meditation. Right, I fed you, I've washed you, given you breakfast this morning, brushed your teeth, taken you to the toilet, sat you down, that's enough, I'm not going to do any more. So the karma chanda is that which keeps you lingering on the body, lingering on the feelings in the body, lingering on the sounds which come into the body. That's what karma chanda is. That degree of enunciation is all very well, but for many people it's not sufficient to get you into the jhanas, because you make that sort of resolution, right, that's enough, I'm not going to bother about you anymore, body, but sort of the body, as it were, you're not used to abandoning the body all at once. So because of that, we have this method of meditation where you abandon the body little by little, stage by stage. You're letting go of karma chanda, letting go of the concern for the sensory world. First thing you're doing is you're letting go of that concern for the world outside of the present moment. Because much of karma chanda, much of the world of the senses, is about the future. It's about desire of what comes next, what I want next. I'm trying to get rid of this discomfort so I can get something better in the future. I'm trying to get rid of this sound so I can get a beautiful sound, so I can get silence or whatever. This is just the world of the sensuality in the future. It's interesting that most of the future and the past is about those five senses. The mind is far more located in the present moment. So the first thing we do is we let go of that part of the body called the past and the future, that part of that world. We also, what the Buddha actually described as a refined form of karma chanda, is called karma vitakka. This is thoughts about that sensory world. This is the fantasies, this is the plans, this is the thoughts, I can't stand this feeling any longer, I want to get something better than this. This is all those thoughts which are all concerned about that world. It's the plans you have for what you're going to do when you leave here. It's the thoughts you have of what we're going to have for lunch today. It's the thoughts which you have about the person sitting next to you. This is all the thoughts concerning that world. The world of bodies. The world of sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches. All of that world is part of karma chanda. The refined part called karma vitakka. Thoughts about the world of the five senses. And this is what we're letting go of in the second stage. We're saying no more thoughts. Now if you can't let go of those thoughts, it shows that you're attached to those thoughts. What you can't let go of is that which you're attached to. And if you're attached to those thoughts, you should ask yourself why. What is it that I'm delighting in? Because it's delight which forms the glue of attachment. What do I really value? Why am I interested in these things? If you have that sort of investigation, you're cutting away at that attachment. Because attachment always needs some sort of glue there, some sort of thing which interests you, some sort of delight which keeps you and the thing that you are looking at attached. That is the bond. If you can see that bond, you can very easily untie it just with truth. So why am I delighting in these things when they're just irritating me? Why do I value these when they never lead anywhere? They never get to truth. If you think like that, if you see like that, then thought eventually just stops. When you take away the value of thinking, it runs out of steam. I remember once when I was a young monk just meditating on the walking meditation path and really investigating, seeing thought and just how useless it was. To see that all thought was completely conditioned by my upbringing, by my training. I would think in a certain way. And the Thai monks would think in a completely different way because their culture was so different. Who was right and who was wrong? Both wrong. All our thinking, both of us, was completely conditioned. Just a repetition of what we'd learned, basically. A recreating of what was already created by our teachers and by our parents. It wasn't going to get anywhere because it was fundamentally flawed. We'd only think in certain ways. Because of that's how we'd been trained. And when you actually started to see that there's no way in the world that thinking can get you anywhere, you can never reveal truth. It was the thinking started to stop. And I remember having some really nice meditations after that, because I'd taken, as it were, the mat from underneath the feet of thinking. And thinking couldn't really establish itself for quite a few days. This is how we can stop that karma vitaka, the thoughts about that world, by seeing how stupid it is, how valueless it is, and how much of an irritation it is. But remember that, that thinking is also part of karma chanda. This is the desires for the world of the five senses, the attachment to that world. The concern for that world, the interest in that world. But it's so hard to get rid of that world all at once, and so the next stage, what we do is we just take one part of that world and abandon everything else. Instead of trying to abandon everything all at once, we just take one part of that world. And that part of the world which we take is just the breath. That's still part of the world of the five senses. Because you're experiencing that breath through the sense of touch. But all the other touches you let go of. All the other sounds you let go of. All the other sights, smells and tastes you let go of. You let go of everything except just one little part of the realm of the five senses. Just the experience of the breath. Until you can keep just that one part. And know that you've abandoned everything else by your ability to sustain your attention just on that one thing for long periods of time. If you can sustain your attention on the breath for long periods of time, you know that you have cut away, you've suppressed, you've abandoned 99% of the realm of sensory concern. That particular hindrance, you weakened it so much there's only a little smidgen left. And that last little smidgen is very easy to overcome as you calm the breath down until it completely disappears. And then you're just left with the realm of the mind. The Samadhi Nimitta comes up. The Samadhi Nimitta comes up. It is a sign of the mind manifesting. It's also a sign that Karma Chanda, the first hindrance, has been successfully overcome. Your concern with the world outside has disappeared. If you can sustain your attention on that Samadhi Nimitta, the sign of concentration, the sign of the mind, it means that it's not just a moment suspension of the first hindrance, but you've actually knocked it out. And it disappears for a long period of time. You know from the experience of the Samadhi Nimitta and by its stability, the Karma Chanda has been overcome. You've got that first hindrance out of the way, one of the most difficult ones. In fact, that is such a difficult hindrance to overcome, when the Buddha described jhanas in the standard formula, he said, Vivicca Kamehi, which is like being separated, being aloof, having left Kamehi, which is the Kamachanda, which is the Kamaloka, which is the world of those five senses. You've left those worlds. That's the description of the first words and the description of the first jhana. When you get that samadhi nimitta, you're just so close, if you can sustain the samadhi nimitta, because you've let go of all concern for the realm of the five senses, for the body. It is why that in mysticism of all religions, they always have to abandon concern for the physical body to get into any mystical states. If you're concerned about what you eat, if you're concerned about the pleasures and pains of the body, there's no way you can be a mystic. There's no way you can find the deeper states of mystical absorption. No way you can get into jhanas, because you're concerned with something which is a direct opposite of the path to the experience of pure mind. So, once we can renounce that world, renounce it even just for 9 days. It'll be there afterwards. You can play around with it afterwards if you really want to. At least for these 9 days, say that you're just going to put enough food in your body just to keep it going. You're just going to sleep enough just to lessen the feeling of tiredness in the body. But you're not going to indulge this body. You're not going to indulge the pleasures. You're not going to be overly concerned about aches, pains, itches, heat and cold. You're not going to be concerned about sounds, because your whole concern is to try and access this mind, to overcome this huge obstacle of the hindrance of sensory concern. Again, the way you overcome that hindrance is through this gradual training, which we do in meditation. Present moment awareness, silent awareness of the present moment. Awareness of the breath, full awareness of the breath. In each of these stages, if you can appreciate just the pleasure of overcoming that hindrance, the sheer peacefulness of it, the sheer delight in the hindrance being weakened and then overcome, then you know the easy path to overcoming that hindrance. When you realize that hindrance causes you problems, when you realize that hindrance is torturing you, then you'll try and escape. That is 90% of the battle. The hindrance stays there because we think it's fun, because we're interested in it, because we value that world. If you realize just how that world imprisons and tortures you, then you're halfway to overcoming that hindrance. You're seeing its suffering, dukkha. So if you can appreciate every moment when that hindrance is weakened, that it's a step towards greater peacefulness, greater contentment, greater inner pleasure, then you'll know how to overcome that hindrance also. For giving away what is coarse and taking up what is refined. It's karma chanda. And it does happen in this retreat, I'm sure for many of you, if not most of you, it will happen. There'll be at least some meditations where you're just completely abandoning just the concern for the breakfast, lunch, sexuality, sensuality, pain, noise, heat, cold. You just give it all up and you go into the realm of the mind, to the point where you're not hearing anything, you're not feeling the body. You're not even thinking about that world. You have this tremendous feeling of freedom. Freedom from all of that. Notice that when that happens, just how beautiful that freedom is. And how delightful is the absence of that first hindrance. Karmachanda. The Buddha described Karmachanda as like being in debt. Because every time you indulge in the five senses, you always have to pay for it afterwards. It's just borrowing happiness. That's why I often say that the happiness of that world is just the pause between two stages of pain. And pain is just the pause between two stages of happiness. When you have a very nice breakfast, just afterwards there's a sense of emptiness there. All that delight is now gone. Now what can I have next to fill up that pain? When you're sick and you get suddenly and you get well, you feel just so good, so happy having sickness disappeared. Why is that? Because pain is finished and you're aware of the happiness which is actually caused by that pain. This is why in the realm of those senses, that which we call pleasure is but a pause between two stages of suffering. That which is suffering is just a pause, a gap between two moments of happiness. We're borrowing, we have to pay back, then we borrow some more, we have to pay back, then we borrow some more, and we have to pay back. That's that world. That's why the Buddha said it's in debt. And when you've paid off your debt, you feel free. You can come and go wherever you wish. This is what it's like when that hindrance has been overcome. You don't have to listen to sounds. You don't have to listen to the body. You are free from the demands of this body. And that's what you experience when that hindrance has been overcome. You just go off into the realm of the mind. And you're not feeling the body at all. You don't have to scratch it. You don't have to move it. You can sit absolutely still because you're not paying attention to the body at all. You're paying just attention to the mind. And you're not at all concerned about pains in the body. You're not afraid of the pains of old age, sickness and death. Because you know something more than that body. You know the world of the mind. In a very real way, that you're taking your first major step towards the deathless, towards that which lies beyond death. Because death in our language concerns the body. It's the death of the body. When we talk about mind, the death of the mind, as it were, is called cessation. But that's another subject altogether. But here, if you can abandon that hindrance of karma chanda, you're also getting very, very close to overcoming your fear of death and the fear of the pains of death and other sicknesses. Because all of that is all in the realm of karma chanda, the first hindrance. The second hindrance, which the Buddha talked about, vayapada and ill will, is also a very important hindrance, especially for Western meditators. The usual explanation is just anger towards another person. And it's very rare in a meditation retreat you find people being angry. But that's not the full extent of the hindrance of ill will. It's also the ill will towards yourself. And that manifests in a very deep way, you're not allowing yourself to bliss out. Not allowing yourself to become peaceful. Not allowing yourself to be successful in the meditation. There are many people, I mentioned this the other night, there are many people who have very deep guilt complexes inside of them. And this, again, this is mostly a Western trait, because this is the way we've been conditioned and brought up. To the point where there was one nun I was talking to a year or two ago, who managed to attain the Samadhi Nimitta, but would not allow herself to go into the deep jhanas. And she told me why. She said that she realized that was really wonderful and very blissful, but she didn't think she deserved it. That is called ill will. That is the second hindrance. That is a subtle form of that hindrance which she saw very clearly as the only thing between her and jhanas. She didn't think she deserved so much bliss. Why don't you deserve so much bliss? You all deserve so much bliss. Why not? There's nothing against it. There's some blisses in this world which are illegal. There's some which break precepts, or which have these terrible side effects like diseases. But there's no deep disease which is transmitted through jhanas. There's no bad side effects at all. And it's not illegal to get into jhanas. It's quite okay. There's no bad side effects whatsoever. But if you look very carefully in the way you meditate, maybe that hindrance is not manifesting at that last step towards jhanas. Maybe it's manifesting earlier on. Maybe that you're not allowing yourself to delight in the meditation. That you're making this hard. That you want to torture the body. You want to deny yourself peace. You want to deny yourself happiness. Because of guilt. Deep inside of you, you think you do not deserve happiness. You don't deserve bliss. You don't deserve freedom. And this is what happens with guilt. When anyone has guilt, the next thing which comes up immediately afterwards is punishment. In a court of law, when a judge finds somebody guilty, they're obliged straight afterwards to consider the sentence, the punishment. Guilt and punishment are inseparable in our culture and in our minds. If we feel guilty about something, the next thing we'll be looking for is a punishment. Denying ourselves some type of pleasure, denying ourselves happiness, denying ourselves freedom. We're punishing ourselves. And people in the West, it's the craziest thing to do, but we keep on doing it. So to overcome that hindrance, and it might be your big hindrance, it's a very difficult one to see. Do loving kindness meditation. Give yourself a break. Say to yourself, the doors of my heart is open to all of me. I allow myself happiness. I allow myself peace. I really have got goodwill to myself. Enough goodwill to myself to allow myself to become really, really peaceful and really bliss out on this meditation. If you find it hard to do loving kindness towards yourself, ask yourself why. Loving kindness, all it is just goodwill, allowing yourself happiness. If you find it difficult, it may well be because there's a very deep-seated guilt complex inside, and you're still wanting punishment. You still haven't forgiven. You still haven't given yourself unconditional, universal forgiveness. One of the beautiful things about Buddhism, the Lord Buddha said, it doesn't matter what anyone else does to you. It doesn't matter how long they've done it to you. It doesn't matter how unfair, how cruel, how undeserving your treatment has been from them. You can still forgive them. Absolutely, once and for all. No matter what a person has done. Sometimes I've seen that in other parts of our culture, people are saying that sometimes some things you just cannot forgive. That's not Buddhism. There's nothing, absolutely nothing, you can't forgive in Buddhism. I just might remember my heart dropping when, after the Dunblane massacre in Scotland, where this crazy man came and shot how many kids, I forget now. Or was a machete or a knife or something, I forget what. But anyhow, that afterwards as a service, I think it was one of the archbishops, it could have been the Archbishop of Canterbury or something, in his sermon said that, I really ask God, and I know you're so forgiven, but don't forgive this man. That some things, I think the Archbishop said, you cannot forgive, and please don't forgive this man. for all the cruelty which he did. And just my heart sank when I heard that a leader of a religion could not offer forgiveness and leadership to heal the pain in the society who'd witnessed such a tragedy. As far as Buddhism is concerned, you can forgive everything, and that forgiveness is healing. That forgiveness is progress. That forgiveness is solving the problems, not creating more. But I can see, because of those attitudes, is reflected in the attitudes one has towards oneself. And very often there's parts which may not be as bad as a Dunblane massacre, but the parts of one's own actions in the past is part of it, part of one's history. Similarly, one cannot bring oneself to forgive. Sometimes that part is buried deep inside of you. Sometimes you've forgotten it. You just know there's something inside you which you're guilty about. Something inside you which you can't forgive. You'd forgotten even what it is. But some reason to deny yourself happiness. Some reason to deny yourself freedom. Some reason to deny yourself jhana and enlightenment. It's the ill will towards yourself. You won't allow meditation to be successful. Check that one out. Try doing some loving kindness meditation. Don't wait till the end of the retreat to do loving kindness meditation. In fact, the retreat I gave at Sydney, I introduced it quite early on, particularly because the ill will is a hindrance which many people just don't really take seriously. It's the ill will towards yourself I'm talking about here. Try loving kindness meditation. Try absolute forgiveness. Whatever's happened in the past, whatever I've done by body, speech or mind, complete absolute forgiveness to the point you completely let go of the past, completely let go of guilt, and you have a nice warm feeling towards yourself. You allow yourself to be happy. You allow yourself to be at peace. What happens now is that whenever happiness comes up into the mind, you're not afraid of it. You don't spoil it deliberately. But you can sustain the happiness of the mind. You can abide with it. You can develop it. You can absorb into it. The happiness, the freedom of the peaceful mind. The other aspect of ill will which I want to bring up is also, for those of you who have been meditating a while and who haven't had great success yet with the meditation, especially meditation on the breath, I say yet because it's only a matter of time. Each one of you has to have success in the end. It's the nature of things that this works. But very often, that if you haven't had success yet, sometimes it's too easy to get a sense of ill will towards meditation, or ill will towards a meditation object. So if you sit down and think, oh, here we go again, I know this is going to hurt. I don't really want to do this, but I have to. So I paid all this money and my friends and I have come. And I've got to be a good Buddhist. This is what Buddhists are supposed to do. And if you actually go into the meditation with ill will towards it, doing it but not really loving to do it, then it's not going to work. You're putting a hindrance up in front of you straight away. Literally, like, I love meditation. I just enjoy it so much that I told fellow monks as soon as I came here, this was great, a meditation retreat. Wow, I was really looking forward to it as I came in this building on Friday afternoon. And you get up in the morning, wow, I'm on a meditation retreat. I don't have to do all this other stuff in the monastery. And that's my attitude towards the meditation. I love it so much that I've got so much goodwill towards it, not the slightest bit of aversion towards it. I just can't get enough, basically. I'm a meditation junkie. And if you've got that sort of attitude towards meditation, then you find that just the mind, as the Buddha said, leaps towards meditation. Whereas the simile I say is that it's like you're walking down the street and a really dear old friend is on the opposite side of the street. You've had such good times together in the past. It doesn't matter where you're going or what you're doing, you can't help yourself. You rush over the street and grab them by the hand, give them a hug and come for a cup of coffee. It doesn't matter, I'm going to be late for a point. It doesn't matter, it's just such a long time since I've seen you. Come on, let's have some time together. It's like a dear old friend. You want to spend time with them. You're willing to drop everything else. That's how I look at meditation. It's this dear old friend. I've had such good times with meditation in the past. If I see meditation just a mile away, I just run towards it and give it a good old hug and take it for a cup of coffee somewhere. And the meditation object, the breath, we had such good times together, me and my breath, best of mates. And that's like the goodwill. And that you can see why it's so easy to watch the breath if that's how you regard the breath. But imagine that, you know, well, you know, you have to be with this breath, and you spent so many hours in agony with this breath. And you see the breath coming along on the other side of the street, oh my God, here it is again. And you try to sort of duck away or hide behind a lamppost so the breath doesn't see you. You just want to escape. And that's ill will towards the breath. Then people do develop that, unfortunately, if they're not pointed out to them. If you regard this meditation as a chore, as not happiness, but sort of something like you do when you go to the gym. You know, you just, no pain, no gain. You've got to push up weights until it really hurts, because you think you're going to get something out of it that way. If that's the way you enter meditation, you've got no hope, ill will. You get to the point you just delight in this meditation. Wow, beautiful. All I've got to do is just sit and have nothing else to do, nothing to build, no letters to write, no phone calls. Nothing to do, just to sit here and just be with a good old friend, the old breath. And if you can do that, you've abandoned ill will, that hindrance, and you've got the opposite, the loving kindness towards your breath. I also gave the simile recently that loving kindness towards the breath, it's just like loving kindness towards a child. If you can look upon your breath like a newly born son or daughter, your child, would you leave that baby at the newsagents and just forget it? Would you drop it as you're walking on the road? Would you lose sight of it? Would the mind wander somewhere else, not taking that along with you? Why is it that we can't keep our attention on the breath? We've got no kindness towards it. We don't delight in it. We don't appreciate it. If you appreciated your breath like your child, those who've never had a child, like someone else who's really, really dear to you, and very vulnerable, you would never abandon it. You'd never lose it. It would always be there with you. You're always checking up to make sure it's still there. This is when you love the breath. However, if you have ill will towards the breath, you find you do leave it other places. You're trying to lose it, basically, because you don't like what you're doing. That's where you wander off. That's where you lose your meditation concentration, because you don't love what you're doing. Basically, you hate what you're doing. You have ill will towards what you're doing. Ill will is a hindrance. You stop that hindrance by loving kindness. Ill will towards yourself by forgiveness. Ill will towards the meditation by goodwill towards the meditation, welcoming the meditation, delighting in it. Goodwill towards the breath by regarding it just like a child, something very valuable and fragile, which you can't spend enough time with. You just want to be there all the time. Like a doting parent, you're a doting meditator. You just dote.